And now, live from Jerusalem, you're listening to Israel Inspired Radio. Here are your hosts, Rabbis Ari Abramowitz and Jeremy Gimpel.
So this is Ari Abramowitz. I'm traveling now throughout America on the speaking tour. Now, I brought along this recording equipment, microphone, schlepping it everywhere, putting it on and off the plane, but there wasn't really enough microphones to do an interview, so I was like, it's going to take meeting someone really interesting to warrant actually setting up this whole studio, figuring it all out, doing an interview, and I was almost through the trip. And I met a lot of interesting people. Okay, I met a lot of interesting people. People, you know, being from Jerusalem, they like open up their souls and share it all. And I've met incredible stories, but this guy, I needed to share it. So his name is Yehoshua Safran. You're an advocate, a lawyer, an activist, an author.
All of the above.
All of the above.
Charged. Yes.
Right. And a Jew, an Orthodox Jew.
Also.
A holy Jew and a lover of Israel.
Amen.
All right. So I guess I gave away the ending to the story. Well, it's not really over yet. I'm sure it's still being written as we speak. But tell us how your story began.
Sure. I was born into a coven of lesbian witches in a Haight-Ashbury commune in San Francisco in 1975.
Okay, period. Say the sentence again.
Sure. I was born into a coven of lesbian witches in a Haight-Ashbury commune in San Francisco. And a coven, for those that don't know, is like a minion, except of 13 witches instead of 10 dudes.
Really?
Yes.
So what does that give them? More power by the combination of their souls?
Yeah, you can't do certain types of ceremonies and certain types of magic you can't do without the right number of witches. So 13 is apparently the lucky number.
Okay. And you were born here, and as far as you know, this was your new normal.
This was normal for me. There was a little bit of a panic in the coven because the witches had prophesied that my mother, a single mom, would bear a little witchling. And they were one of the witches held me aloft when I was born and supposedly said, oh my goodness, she's got, or oh my goddess is actually what she said. Oh my goddess, she's got a penis. They didn't know what to do with a boy because they were so women-centric, women-focused. And after some back and forth and some spells and meditation, they decided that they would raise me to be a warlock, and that would be the way that they would deal with the boy.
Uh-huh. So that's usually young Jewish boys have their, you know, have it looked at in a different
right.
way and cut and snipped, right? And you, that was a different experience.
Took me 21 years to get to that experience.
Yes. 21 years.
Yes,
so, okay, so walk us through that.
Yeah. Well, so right away, my mother, this group of radical feminist lesbian witches that my mother was a part of was, they were troubled, as I said, by having a boy in their midst. And as my mother called it, they had an anti-man vibe to them. And she began to separate from them a little bit, in part because I was a boy. And in part because one of my earliest memories is I was probably about 4. And my mother came back and she said, you know, she called me Joshy. And she said, you know, Joshy, you can be out there tripping your brains out on LSD, but it's starting to feel like church. And she had had a circumstance where one of the high priestesses, one of the high witches, had scolded her for not kneeling at the right part of the ceremony to the goddess at the full moon when they were on acid. And my mother felt that, believe it or not, witchcraft was becoming too organized of a religion. And she had to get out because it wasn't free enough. And this is, you know, my mother is someone who, she was brought up with communist parents.
Okay.
And their Stalinist values were too materialistic for her. So that's why she came west to overthrow the U.S. government and reclaim the goddess from the patriarchy.
Reclaim the goddess from the patriarchy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So these were the values you were raised on, the
yes.
worldview, the religious view. You didn't know you were a Jew.
I had no idea that I was Jewish. I knew that, based on the way that my mother told me, that there had been a goddess that everyone worshipped, and at some point a bunch of horrible men came in and imposed a patriarchy and took away the goddess and replaced it with a mean, angry old god man. And we were leaders. We were in an exciting time because we were going to bring the goddess back, and that was going to somehow kind of heal the world.
You know, there's something so holy about Jews. You know what I mean? That,
yes.
like, she... was trying to replace an old flawed image and understanding of God. She knew intuitively it was wrong.
Right.
And there was something better and more beautiful.
Right.
So she happened to be totally off base, in my
right.
opinion,
right.
about what that was. But it doesn't make any less of an authentic, admirable journey.
And I don't want to give anything away, but there was a time much later in my life where I was outside dancing in a circle for Kiddush Levana, like I did this evening, celebrating the waxing moon. And my mother, who happened to be visiting me in when I was in yeshiva in Israel, nudged me and said, not that different from the coven.
You know? My goodness.
You know? So I had to give it to her. But yeah, I mean, I later learned in researching for my book, Free Spirit, and just sort of trying to make sense of my childhood, that a lot of the witches that my mother was involved in, with were Jews, and that they had taken a lot of what they felt were the best of Judaism and repackaged it for themselves.
It's a feeling that I'm getting. I was just at a synagogue in, not going to say where it was, but a lot of the parents were coming up to me afterwards. This was an Orthodox synagogue. And truly besides themselves, distraught about their children intermarrying or interdating, and there's nothing that they can do about it, and they can't stand against it. And one of them asked me in front of the whole group, they said, why is this happening? Yeah. And I said, well, when you send your kid to Sunday school, and number one, it ruins his weekend, okay?
Right.
And like so that's Judaism to him, is ruining his weekend on an emotional level. And then you spoon feed him liberalism wearing a kippah.
Right.
And say that it's Jewish, that, you know, what is there to hold on for?
Right.
Well, so we've all, you know, been spoon-fed understandings and perceptions of God that are off base.
Yeah.
My question is, what's it like to be a kid having been told this as your now worldview? Like,
right.
she wasn't raised this way. How was she raised?
She was raised in a household of Yiddish-speaking stern communists who, like my mother, were committed to the overthrow of the U.S. government. But they thought that that was going to happen through sort of a classic Marxist taking control of the means of production. And, you know, my grandfather wore a suit and a tie, and he was a professor. And, you know, they draped themselves in middle class respectability, which to my mother was outrageous.
Hypocrisy.
Yeah, which is hypocrisy. If you want to change the world, you change it by taking off your clothes and lighting things on fire, not by giving lectures in lecture halls. You know,
right.
Lecture halls have got to be burned down, you know?
Right.
And she did her best to do that. She burned a lot of stuff down in the 60s. And she thought that, you know, she didn't send me to school, for example. She didn't want me to interact with any of the hallmarks.
You had no formal schooling.
I did not go to school until sixth grade. Yeah, I was nominally homeschooled by my mother, who from time to time, you know...
tried to teach you how to read.
Well, so, you know, it was interesting. By the time I crawled into school, I was reading Dostoevsky and, you know, Kurt Vonnegut and, you know, Marx and everything else, and talking about feminist theory and Latin American politics, and referred to Reagan as a war criminal. But I didn't know how to do math or science, or how to read and write in cursive, which at the time, at least, was a big deal. I learned how to... write poetry and fashion tampons out of organic sea sponges and all of the things that a growing boy needs to know, according to my mother. I didn't have any of the conventional... My mother thought that... She literally said, this was something she said. She said, school is no place for kids. It teaches capitalism, teaches violence, teaches competition. And these are bad, bad attributes that we need to move to a barter-based system, to a cooperative system, to a loving system. And that's the future that we're going to build for ourselves.
I just can't help but deeply admiring your mother. I know
yeah.
from, like, as a child, if you had anyone to compare yourself to, which it doesn't sound like you did, there were probably times that you felt like, why can't I just be normal, right? But
later, yeah, as a tween... I began to get a sense of, well, wait a second, you know, this isn't normal. And as I began to feel that way, so take a step back. I mean, my mother, in part because of the concerns about the authorities noticing that I wasn't going to school, and in part because Ronald Reagan got elected in 1980, my mother thought that nuclear war was imminent and was gonna come. And so she decided that since the revolution had failed at the end of the Vietnam War, we were going to go to the hills. We were going to, she was going to train me up to be a leader for the future when the next draft happen when the next revolution came, and then I'd be situated to come and move into the streets and show people how to do things.
So back to what I was saying, I admire about her.
Yes.
I admire her intellectual honesty, that she did what she believed was true and the right thing to do at the time, even though it may have seemed when you figured out a little bit like negligence, and one could judge her from that perspective, but she really thought she was doing what's right. But to give a kid, a Jewish kid, a perception of like Wicca, lesbian goddesses and stuff like that, how did you end up a religious Jew now? Tell me about that sort of spiritual journey you're on.
Sure. So, you know, it's funny. My mother, in her own way, did a good job of creating a real thirst for spiritual connection, which I still have and I never stopped having. And from the earliest age, I had certain experiences. I was blessed or cursed with having a lot of life or death experiences in my somewhat negligently administered childhood. So I felt a connection to something beyond me that couldn't be explained by reason and science alone. But I had a real problem with my mother's paganism, and later she was a shamanist, because primarily not so much because it was idol worship, which it sometimes was, but because it was so contrived. I mean, I would see my mother and her friends over some like organic tempeh tofu dish, voting on what they believed in or voting on what the ceremony would consist of. And I thought, I don't want to like vote on what God is or vote on what the tradition is. I want to be part of something that's authentic, that in my mind is real and is true. And I didn't have much exposure to anything until I was 9. And we were living on the side of a mountain. My mother had just met a Salvadoran Marxist guerrilla commander who she was about to marry, but we were walking on this trail and there was a cabin and we...
What does that mean, guerrilla commander?
Today we might call him a terrorist, but he was a revolutionary leader, paramilitary forces in El Salvador fighting against the U.S.-backed government. Okay. There was a civil war in El Salvador.
Right.
And he was sort of a Che Guevara figure, or so my mother thought. But we met this guy who turned out to be a New Yorker, and my mother was talking to him, and he said, "Where are you from?" And my mother said, "Oh, we're from the Bay Area." And he said, "Ain't no Lanceman from the Bay Area." And my mother thought that was hilarious, and they were talking about all these things. And my mother said, "How did you know we were Jews?" And the guy said, "Oh, look at your kid. He's got a rabbi's nose." My mother thought that was hilarious. And we walked back out into the mist on this temperate rainforest, you know, and I'm like, what are we? That guy knew me because my face, my nose, you know, I had no idea what they were talking about. And she said, "Oh no, he said that he was the only Italian kid in Brooklyn who had not one but two bar mitzvahs." And I was like, "What does that mean? I don't know anything that you're saying." She's like, "Oh yeah, I guess I never told you that we're Jewish before, but we're Jews."
And how old were you?
I was nine.
Just never came up in conversation.
Never came up. We were hitchhiking at that point across the rural West. No running water, electricity, no telephone, no toilet, no refrigerator. You know, we were out there and meeting all kinds of strange and sundry people. And so when I asked her, I was like, "What does that mean?" And she said, "Well, what were Jews like? Marx, Freud, Einstein, you know?" And I said, "Like, you know, we're related to them?" And she said... And bless my mother. She said, "Yeah, like kind of like we're related to them." And then she gave, I think, a really
good... I appreciate that answer, because I really would have hated to hear co-religionists. Because we're a family. That's something we've really lost when we're out of Israel. But you feel it more, I think, in Israel, that we're a family. You know? So how did you feel when you found out that you have all these cousins you didn't know about?
Well, you know, she said, and this was, bless her, she said, "We should go to the library and look it up. Because I don't really know what it means, you know." And I said, "Okay, you know, great." So the next time we hitchhiked down the mountain, we were in a library, and I looked it up. I think it was an Encyclopedia Britannica. And I looked it up, and I was like, "Oh, we're this ancient tribe that emerged from the mists of prehistory to bring God and morality and the Torah, the law, to the nations of the world. And we're like the original thing. We're like the oldest tribe that's still around, and we're still doing, and we have these rituals that are like 3,500 years old." So I'm reading this and I'm trembling, because here I am, a kid who's traveling from place to place with no sense of affiliation.
Do you remember what book that was?
I think it was the Encyclopedia at the library.
So the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Okay. Yeah. And it had this kind of archaic the Hebrews or, you know, whatever. And which for me at that time and place was kind of a powerful thing to read because it felt that much older. And as I began reading, literally in the library in Snohomish and Skagit counties in Washington State, what I'm seeing in Jewish history was a parallel to my own life, which is moving from place to place, kind of being a despised and reviled minority wherever we go, yet being scholastic and reading books and learning and talking and arguing about things. And my mother, to her credit, treated me like an adult from my earliest age. So we were always arguing and talking about things as though I was, you know, I was in on decision making. Where do you want to hitchhike to today? Let's go to Idaho. Okay, we're going to Idaho. You know.
All right, let's take a vote out there. Who wants to take a little parenthesis that I usually will not do in the middle of a show, but the spirit is moving me to ask you to make a joke? It's a joke you told me today that was among the best. It was just so good.
The joke about the rabbi?
Stand or do we sit?
Right. So the joke that I forget who told me this in Israel many years ago, but of a new young rabbi who's kind of naive. He comes to his new congregation that's hired him, and the time comes for Kriyat Shema in the evening to say the Shema, and he notices that like half the congregation is sitting and half the congregation is standing. And after the end of Mari for the evening service, some of the congregants come up and they said, Rabbi, this is just outrageous. Those guys over there are standing, and the tradition in the shul has always been to sit. And the other faction is like, that's ridiculous. We always stand. No one ever sits. These guys are these total heretics. They have no idea what they're talking about. And finally, someone says, you know, there's this old guy. He's like 102 years old. He's down in the nursing home. We'll go and ask him and see how this congregation used to do it back in the good old days when we knew what we were doing. And the rabbi says, okay. So they go down and they meet with this old guy, and he's a little out of it. And the rabbi says, so did you sit when you were doing the Kriyat Shema? And the old guy's like, oh. And the other side says, no, we stood during the Kriyat Shema. And the guy says, oh. And they said, yeah, why are you trying to influence him? Step away from the old man. You don't know what you're talking about. No, you're being you brought Kugel just to entice him to your side. No, you're an idiot. You're a moron. And the old man says, this was how it was in my
day. Okay, so, joke told on it, but it was so good because that's really so true.
Yes.
You know, as I'm traveling around, I speak to Jewish groups, I'm doing schools and universities, but I meet a lot of Christian groups, and they really, we have conversations regularly that the way Jews argue, it's so admirable to them. They don't get it because they get in an argument, and if it's like a real argument, there's going to be a new denomination in Christianity.
Right. You know? Someone's
and
dead.
Jews, when there's nothing to argue about, one side has to go out of his way to make something up to find it just so you can argue about that thing.
Right.
It's like a way of bonding because like iron sharpens iron. You get to a deeper truth.
Yes,
but this is more a Jewish nuance where right now you're sitting in the library in Washington State reading about...
I'm sitting in the library, I'm in Washington State, I'm having this sense of connection to Judaism, and at that point, I have, my connection, I would say, is racial. I have a racial connection. I know that I belong to a people, and, you know, my grandmother, for example, the very few times I saw her, I'd say, like, where are we from? Where is our family? Everyone's from somewhere. Where are we from? Who knew? Who knew where we were from? Well, what do you mean? You know, like, where are we? They kept changing the border. No one knows where it was. Today, it's all gone. You know, it's like, what does this even mean, right? So suddenly I had this sense of meaning, of connection, and a sense of chosenness, quite frankly, that I'm belonging not only to some family tree, but a special family tree. There's something that's important there. But it didn't really have a spiritual aspect. So it gave me a sense of identity, which this guerrilla commander that my mother married was also a violent alcoholic, and that sense of connection was also important for me. A sense that somewhere out there, I thought maybe there might be a million Jews left on earth scattered all over the place. Who knows where they are today? The Encyclopedia Britannica wasn't clear on that. But I thought, you know, there's a homeland somewhere that Jews came from the land of Israel, and maybe someday I'll be able to go back to this homeland. And that was really the beginning of my identity. But again, without a spiritual component yet.
Which is fortunate. Because it sounds like you got what your mother never got, which is a totally blank slate.
That's true.
You know, there's a lower intermarriage rate, lower intermarriage from Jews, between Jews and non-Jews, among Jewish kids that get zero Jewish education versus Sunday school.
Sunday school
increases the intermarriage rate.
I have a friend who I actually went to Israel with, and we were talking about this experience, and he said his overriding memory of his Sunday school in Tucson, Arizona, was building a scale model of Auschwitz out of sugar cubes. which sent a shiver through me. And I thought, man, if that had been my exposure to Judaism, I would definitely not be in Israel today. I'd be like, you know, taking peyote on some ranch and, you know, somewhere, right? I mean, this just wouldn't be my path.
Yeah, it wouldn't be your path. Yeah, to you, it became this, like, shrouded mystery of, like, Camelot on a hilltop with a light on a hilltop. That's, like, that's what it is. Yeah. You know, that's actually the truth.
It is.
And I'm living there.
Yeah.
You were telling me a story about the Tanach.
Right, right. So this was the beginning of my spiritual awakening, and which was almost accidentally also Jewish, right? So I had this sort of racial identity, and what my mother had dated this like Mennonite Rastafarian guy, which is a really interesting combination if you think of sort of dreadlocks and no upper facial hair. But this dude was into reggae music, and he made me a mixtape of Bob Marley songs. And there was something about reggae. My mother was into like radical 60s rock and jazz, which traumatized me. But when I listened to reggae and I listened to Bob Marley, there was something, there was an authenticity and a truth, a spiritual truth to that music that the downbeats on 1 and 4, 1 and 3, you know, like hit my soul somehow on this very deep level. And Bob Marley's words, more than anything, you know, all the other pop music at the time is about basically love and sex, which it still is. And yet that wasn't at all what Bob Marley was singing about. And he was singing things like the stone that the builder refused shall be the head cornerstone. And that kind of music spoke
for listeners out there. That's Evan Ma'asu Habonim Haitala Rosh Pina.
That's right.
That's from Hallel.
We say
that,
right?
It's twice, a beautiful, beautiful pasuk. So that stuck with you.
That stuck with me. I didn't know exactly what it meant, but I knew that I had been the stone that the builder had refused. I was someone who was an outcast in society. And I didn't know exactly what a head cornerstone or a Rosh Pina, you know, would be. But I knew it meant that things were going to be good. And that not only they were going to be good, but the adversity that I was facing was going to be really important in helping make my life great someday. That was what I took from the lyric. And my mother was, you know, again...
By the way, how old is this? You're listening to this? How old
are you? So I'm listening to this song maybe around the age of 12 or 13.
Okay.
And we had, at that point, escaped from my violent alcoholic Marxist guerrilla commander stepfather. We're in rural Washington still.
Was that a relief to get away from that?
It was a total relief. I mean, it got to the point that I was, at the age of 12, I was basically plotting to kill him. I had come to the realization that I couldn't stand by to see my mother brutalized by this guy anymore. And when I sort of began to provoke inner conflict with him myself, and he began to attack me physically. And that for me was, I wanted that because I wanted to kill him. And luckily for me, that crossed the line for my mother, that it was somehow okay for him to beat her. But when the violence came to me, she couldn't handle it. And suddenly she sort of woke up. And we ended up running away in the middle of an afternoon and hiding out in a basement, in this family's basement, for a summer before we ended up on this commune by the Canadian border. So in the midst of this sort of, a renaissance, a renewal of, okay, we're free from this guy. We're at the thrift store together, and my mother picks up this blue book. At this point, she's a shamanist. She's doing these Native American long dances, like depriving herself of sleep and dancing for 24 hours at a time. And this book is the Tanach. It's written on it, the T-A-N-A-C-H, the Tanach. And it's this blue kind of Bible-looking book. And I said, you know, what is this? Usually she's finding books on Kundalini yoga or whatever. And she said, well, it's the Hebrew scriptures. It's the Hebrew Bible. And I said, why are you buying a Bible? That seems just weird. Why would you, some weird, you know.
Antithetical to anything.
Some biblical
organized religion.
Yeah, it's just, this is, you know. And my mother said, well, in this community, and we were living in a very fundamentalist evangelical community that was pretty anti-Semitic. I mean, if you thought that
you were
Jewish.
Are you sure they're evangelical or fundamentalist? Meaning, usually evangelicals tend to be more pro-Jew, pro-Israel, whereas like Catholics often or Lutherans or tend to be, I mean, more anti-Israel, anti-Semitic than evangelicals. But I don't
know. Right. Yeah, it's a good question. So this was like, you know, the late 80s in rural Washington State. I mean, these folks, I thought of evangelical meaning that they were doing outreach, their own sort of, not
like Jewish, missionary.
Missionary, okay. Like they were trying to convert you, right? And the pitch always, if they found out you were Jewish, was, oh, you're going to hell. You're going straight to hell, and you're a terrible person. You're going to hell. But I have an out for you, and here's this out. You buy this salvation, and you know. And so it was always an uncomfortable, you know, that's always an awkward conversation to have in the thrifty foods when you're picking up some half and half from the, you know, dairy counter. But so she said, well, we have to buy this book because if the wrong people get their hands on it, they'll burn it. And we have a duty to protect this book. And it was suddenly my mother was like this, you know, Da Vinci Code heir to this Jewish thing, obviously. And I didn't know where that was coming from.
Yeah, and I shared with you at lunch when we were speaking about it, the thought that I had that as I'm traveling around, I meet these people that love Israel so much, tears in their eyes, and they're like, thank you for protecting the Torah for us for thousands of years. And I was like, the protector of the scroll.
Right, you know, exactly.
And then I hear the story, and that's what she was doing.
That's what she was doing. And we were at the end of the earth. There was no one else but us to protect.
And it just shows that you're a Jew, you're a Jew. You know, like when it comes down to it, like she bought the book, protected it, and
my daughter, thank God, this last Pesach, we were in Israel, she had her bat mitzvah in Israel. She was the first B'nai mitzvah, either bar or bat mitzvah, in 110 years of my family. Right?
Wow.
First person at that age to have the ceremony, right?
That is unbelievable. 110 years. And it just shows, you know, like it was Hezekiah didn't want to have a son. Because he knew he would be evil.
Right, Menashe.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. And what was the truth? They're like, okay, but what about Menashe's son and his son and his son and his son? We just don't have the eyes to see what's going to come eventually.
Right.
But Hashem's in charge of that, you know? Hashem, so like...
Yes, so that, yeah, I mean, and my wife actually, it was like 118 years, which makes my family the firmer family. So, no, honestly, I mean, you know, we generations of communists and... So she saved this book, and I didn't think much of the book. And then one night, I was stacking cordwood by a bonfire out on the commune, and I'm singing the stone that the builder refused. I'm singing this Bob Marley song. And my mother goes, oh, you know, that's from Psalms. I don't know how she knew that, but she knew that. And I said, what are you talking about? This is not some weird Bible crap.
Bob Marley was a religion to you at this time, right?
Like... Bob Marley was a prophet to me. He was. I didn't exactly have all the trappings of the religion, but his message and his music and the teachings that he shared in his music were my religion, essentially. And
No Woman, No Cry.
No Woman, No Cry. Well, that was like one of his few songs that was like didn't resonate with me because I was like, oh, that's, you know,
right. That's
about love and, you know.
Right.
But I mean, he has some, Bob Marley has some wild lyrics. I mean, he has for example. I mean, you know, he's got some radical stuff.
He was a spiritual
stuff seeker.
And so you have this prophet. And you're listening, and what happens? Go ahead.
So my mother pulls out this Tanach and hands me the book. No, it's from Psalms. And at this point in my life, I'm rejecting everything that my mother stands for because I've realized that not only have I been deprived throughout my entire childhood, but I've been unnecessarily deprived because my mother didn't want me to have TV or sugar or television or running water, electricity to be on the grid, all these things. And I've now experienced those things, at least a little bit. And the world hasn't ended, and my brain hasn't imploded, and it's awesome. Sugar's amazing. I love sugar, right? Television is the best thing ever. Like, how could I have been depressed? I felt so angry with her. And so I sat down with the book of Psalms to show her that she had no idea what she was talking about. I was going to read the book and prove the negative. It's not in there. It's not in there, right? And as I sat working my way through this endless pages of poetry, I realized, first of all, like half of Bob Marley's lyrics were from the Book of Psalms, which was a huge wake-up call to me because here I am, this guy who's obsessed with authenticity, and it turns out Bob Marley had been plagiarizing all his stuff from the source. And Bob Marley always talks about roots. You got to go back to your roots. And so I was like, well, this is roots. This is roots. And then, of course, I find the lyric, Evan Masu Abonim Hatala Rosh Pina. But I find something else, too, which is that these poems attributed to King David are a David basically on the run from Shaul in the wilderness. He's a young man, and he's like crying out for help. He's like, you know, Hashem, help me. I'm out here. I'm struggling. There's some bad guy hunting me. And at that point, we were sort of still on the run from my stepfather. And yet he's writing these beautiful things about being in the natural world and his connection to God and love. And so that book of Psalms just totally resonated with me. And I felt like, I literally felt like he was reaching across a 3,000-year chasm from my own ancestry and like touching me, you know, giving me a pat on the shoulder and an embrace. So that was a really powerful moment. And I felt a sense of chosenness there, that this book, that 1,000 people could read this book and it wouldn't resonate with them, but it did with me. Like it was special to me. And, subsequently I found that there have been a few other people who found that experience too. But at that time and place in rural Washington State, I was like, this is my scene. And then I flipped the book over finally. And I thought, well, how does this begin, right? You know, and the book begins in the beginning. I was like, okay, that's a good place to begin, is in the beginning. And the stories of Abraham in particular, of someone who's coming from a place of idol worship and crossing over into an unknown land, and he has to forge his own path, that for a tradition based on tradition, it begins with a guy who eschews tradition, right? It says, I'm ripping it up and starting over again. And then for me, the other powerful story was the Moses story, of a guy who's fundamentally grown up so much in Gentile society. He basically is a Gentile. His lips can't even speak Hebrew properly. He's totally disconnected with the Jewish people. But like me, he goes out in the wilderness. Like me, he has these sort of God-like experiences with talking to God in the bushes. And then when he finally makes his approach to the Jewish people, not only do they accept him as one of their own, but they hoist him onto their shoulders and say, lead us. And to me, I thought, wow, this is like the opposite of every cult that my mother got us involved with, every religious tradition where, oh yeah, first you got to sit at the guru's feet for 12 months without speaking and, clean his shoes. And then you get to maybe talk to him and, you got to prove yourself. And whereas this Moses experience was like, come on in, as the outsider, you're the ultimate, leader that we want. So I felt like that was an important invitation to me spiritually to come check out the Jewish people.
And there was you mentioned this theme continued to connect you and inspire you to Judaism all the way until you were in Jerusalem,
It did. So I went to, I got into Oberlin College in Ohio, and I went, the first week I was there, I went to the Federation of Greater Cleveland, and I just walked in the front door. This was before Birthright or anything. And I basically said, look, I'm this Jewish guy. I don't have any Jewish community. I don't have a rabbi. I don't have any learning. But I want to go home to Israel, and like, I want you to send me to Israel. And this African-American lady who worked there was like, okay, well, we'll buy you a ticket. And she just like, you got you a ticket. And I was like, great, thanks.
Where was this?
This was Cleveland, Ohio, where it was near Oberlin College.
And that is shocking. I think when this show is aired, federations are going to be swamped. This is my family of 12. We've never been to Israel.
When I didn't know better. It wasn't a matter of chutzpah. I just assumed, well, if they're the Jews, they'll want me to go home.
That's what they should have done. I'm proud of them. I love hearing stories about federations doing things like that. Because sometimes the federations aren't that easy to fall in love with.
And since I haven't had a lot of love for a lot of federations, to be honest with you, now that I'm sort of a professional, in the community. But at the time, I was just like, oh, righteous, these guys got me a ticket. And I sort of stumbled off the plane in Israel with my long hair and a flannel shirt and continued doing what I'd done as a kid, which was trying to hitchhike across Israel. And I didn't have much money, so I was trying to sleep on park benches and in parks and on lawns and, these kind of things. And because it's Israel, wherever I went, people were like, people are running up, yelling at you. And I sort of sat up and was like, oh, well, I don't have any place to go. And they're like, in l'chama kom? And I'm like, no, I don't have a place to go. I don't know, And then, of course, because it's Israel, there are these angry people who are busting me for sleeping on the park bench. They're like, oh, well, why don't you come back and eat with my family and live with us, because that's...
And this is regular. This happened.
This happened multiple times. And I ended up...
And you said
up,
it was an immediate shift in tone.
It was an immediate shift in tone the second they sort of realized that I wasn't some, I don't know what they thought, some drug addict who was passed out, that I was just like this young guy who literally didn't have a place to go. Then I was like, oh, well, if you don't have a place, I have an obligation to provide you with a place, which is, given hitchhiking across the American West, you can't... you show up in town, you're grubby, you're tired, you're smelly. People are like,
they don't really look at you.
You come on my land, I'll shoot you. And they will shoot you. There's no concept of hospitality to the stranger, nothing. And then I got scooped up at the Kotel by this Asia Torah group who brought me up to services to davening. And this was really the key moment for me when I knew I was gonna that the Jewish people were like welcoming me back is we had this tefillah and the this prayer service, and they said, okay, now we're gonna bring up the high priest, the Kohens, the priests, and they're gonna do the blessing like they used to do in the temple in Jerusalem. So I was all excited. I was like, they're gonna bring up the high priest. He's probably gonna be wearing some cool outfit and do this stuff that the priests do. And they said, are there any Kohanim here? And this dude with like a tattered leather jacket and ratty orange dreadlocks and a big nose ring like raises his arm and is like, yeah, we're all I'm a Kohen. And I'm looking at this kind of London London gutter punk guy. And having grown up the way I did, I thought, God, it's going to be so embarrassing when they have to call security to drag this guy out because he's delusional. He thinks that he's like a priest of Israel, yeah. Right? And there's these great rebbeim, these rabbis at the front of the room. They're not going to, what are they going to do with this guy, right?
And these are like the, you know, rabbis of the world, among the leading rabbis in the world.
And we're in Jerusalem overlooking the Kotel in this like Jerusalem.
Like I have rabbinical ordination. When I'm in Jerusalem and someone screams rabbi, I don't turn around.
Exactly.
Because I don't know like a speck of on the toenail of one of my rabbis, you know.
Right,
so, but
right.
If I'm in the Far East and I'm in China, they say rabbi. Here I'm a rabbi.
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
But we're talking about Jerusalem, like at the old city. So
this is at the source, and these guys, these rabbis, have these very impressive long beards and the whole getup, you know. And what happens? The next thing I know, they've brought up this British gutter punk dude with the dreadlocks, and they're draping him in the sacred talit, this prayer shawl, and he's raising his hands up, and like the whole congregation, including these rabbis, are accepting the blessing from the priest of Israel. And I thought, man, this is still, they say they're the people of Moses in Israel. They still are the people of Moses in Israel. Like literally, this guy just rolled out of South London or wherever he's from, and they're accepting him for who he says he is, you know? And that had me. I mean, at that moment, I was like, I want to hitch my wagon to this train, because it is a righteous people that welcomes in the stranger, and it's a 3,500 year tradition. You can just see it, and it's unbroken. And I want to reconnect. And the next thing that happened to me was I wanted to visit the four holy cities of Israel, and that really appealed to me. And so I was in Hebron in Kiryat Arba actually, and it was like Friday afternoon, and suddenly the store is closing. They're trying to kick me out, and I'm like, "Why are you kicking me out?" Oh, Shabbat is coming, and I'm like, "It's only like 1 p.m." Yeah, and the buses have stopped running, and like we get, you know, and I'm like, "If the buses stop running, I was going to go back to Jerusalem and stay at the hostel there. And I don't know, what am I going to do?" And these two guys who are in line, who are impossibly old, meaning they're probably like 40, like my age now, and these two guys start fighting with each other over who's going to have the honor of taking this long-haired, flannel-shirted dude back to their house to sleep and eat with their family, you know, for the Sabbath. And I was just like, I was basically overcome with tears, to the point of tears, to see that these guys were so intent on bringing me into their home and so trusting that they were actually fighting with each other, almost to the point of blows, about who would have the honor, you know. And that happened again and again and again wherever I went in Israel. And you know, it's, I mean, to the lack of credit, a little bit, of the American Jewish experience, it's something you just really very rarely feel in America. It's just a feeling that you can't feel. And in Israel, it's like...
Why do you think that's the case?
Well, I mean, I think it's... people bemoan assimilation, and they use that word a lot. And I don't know exactly what that means, but I know that that unbroken biblical spirit that emanates from the ancient spirituality of the land of Israel and tribalism and being a people has become so dull and numb that, you know, I mean, I think
there's something that just being in the land of Israel, it's not connected to level of observance. That's what I see when I'm in Israel. Mm-hmm. People could be more observant, less observant. Yeah. There's something that transcends the observance to just this holistic Jewish biblical way of seeing things, whether you're connected to, you know, the,
right.
You know?
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I'll give you an example. My mother, who, believe it or not, you know, that at that point, she was still in her shamanistic group. She came to visit me, actually, to come to stay for Pesach, when a year later, when I was doing my junior year abroad in Beersheba. And we're on the bus to Beersheba, and this is back in the day, but I'm sure it still happens. Of course, immediately, like, the Egged bus breaks down, like, in the middle of the desert on the way to Beersheba, right? It's like, night is coming, you know, we're in the middle of the desert, there's, like, jackals howling, you know. And the bus driver's like, they're going to send, like, a replacement bus in 2 hours, you know. And so my mother, you know, my mother sits down cross-legged in the desert and begins eating her food. Okay, we're going to have to wait for 2 hours. And within, I kid you not, 5 minutes, every single car going by sees the bus, pulls over, what's happening? Okay, get in, where are you going?
Yeah.
And we're like the third, some random dude, you know, secular Israeli guy is like, come on in, I'm taking you home.
Yeah,
you know?
For me, when I see a hitchhiker, the only question, it's not, well, am I going to stop, but if I stop too short right now, am I going to get in an accident?
Right.
You know, because they stand in weird places also that make it a challenging thing. You take a sharp turn and they're at the corner.
Right.
So,
right.
But no, and if it wasn't for the terror,
right,
that the fear that you're getting in the car with someone that you shouldn't, or the whole, there would never be, it would be the most efficient transportation system in the world.
Right. It would. It's true.
If it wasn't just for the terror, but there's like those terrorist threats that have happened. Soldiers aren't allowed legally to hitchhike.
Right.
Which is so sad, because if there's anyone that can pick up, the first car that will stop spot will pick up a soldier.
Right.
Who's hitchhiking.
And they're so, the most deserving. Yeah, I know. But look at the Mishnah. I mean, you know, people have been trying to mess up Jewish tradition and ritual in the land of Israel forever. You know, I'm reminded of the Mishnah of Rosh Hashanah, right, where they had the signaling to announce the new moon, and immediately, you know, people are running up to send up false flares to mess up the Jewish calendar. You know, it's like, yeah, okay, you know. But yeah, so for me, that kind of achnasat orachim or hospitality was so overwhelming that it was just, it was such a root, such an authentic connection. And then the other thing is, you know, I did have the advantage of living in Beersheba, and I think that, you know, perhaps religious folks don't focus on this as much these days, but to be there where I'm helping to tutor these Ethiopian olim coming in, and I'm tutoring them in English for their English class, you know, and they're psyched to be there. I mean, they're like, we are home, right? And there's all these, I was there, it was in Beersheba in the mid-90s before going to yeshiva, and all these Russian guys, you know, who are like, yeah, we're here, and Argentinians, and the Indian Moshav of folks from India, and this sense of like, yeah, it's like this is the kibbutz, the great ingathering of the exiles, and it's an amazing and beautiful thing, and it's a more diverse place than like.
That's interesting. Places, I really like that angle.
Yeah,
you know, because you're experiencing all of these other Jews that are diving in, and there must be a voice like, I want to dive in too. Why am I standing at the edge of the pool?
Exactly.
And what was the answer you gave yourself?
Well, so for me, I guess I began going to shul when I was there in Beersheba. And of course, shul was in Iraqi Beit Knesset with like these dudes who were all dressed like they had been businessmen in Iraq in like 1950. This is in Beersheba. And I'm like the youngest guy by 30 years, but that's where I was, you know, junior year abroad. So I'm starting to go to this shul. And these guys.
This is in college.
This is when I was in college. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. At Ben Gurion University. And these guys are psyched to have me, you know, because I'm like, they finally have a guest, right, for Shabbat. And so I'm hanging out with these, like, Iraqi guys. And I think part of what moved me about it, too, was that I think my mother had raised me with this insidious notion, right, that Israel was a colonial enterprise, right, that it was basically like, quote-unquote, white Jews who had gone to colonize the indigenous peoples of, you know, of Palestine.
It's always sad for me when Jews, you know, the whole hook, line, and sinker. They think just to be a liberal leftist, you got to believe it all. You can believe all that other nonsense.
Right.
But when it comes to your own nation, the beating heart of your people, you got to be more discriminating.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Well, and that, and there was no experience like living in Beersheba to repudiate that. Because here are, you know, a large swath of the world who are refugees because they were Jews and coming home to Israel to make literally the desert bloom in a place where literally no one had ever lived before because it was inhospitable. You know, I mean, there was no denying any of that. And I think that was a really powerful experience. And after that, I basically wanted to go to yeshiva. I wanted to learn and to be reclaim the heritage that had been, you know, out of the system for 100 years, 110 years.
So you did that? You went to
yeshiva?
I did that.
I went to yeshiva in Sfat.
Called what?
Called Shalom Rav. run by a guy named Rav Rafael Weingott, who's the Rosh Yeshiva. And, you know, Rav Weingott's criteria was, you know, I called up to apply from, I'd gone back to Washington State to harvest peas in the fields again after college because I needed money to go to Israel. And I contacted this yeshiva and I said, you know, I want to apply. And he goes, okay, good, you're in. I met the guy. And then I said, well, what about the tuition? And he goes, well, we'll talk about it when you get here. And I said, well, you know, I need to make sure that I'll have enough money before I show. He's like, well, why don't you just come over here now, and then we'll figure out the tuition when you get here. You know, that was like this thing. So I ended up showing up. You know, and I can while he's talking to me on the phone, there's like, I can hear singing and dancing in the background. You know, I'm like, all right, this will work out. And I'd always wanted to go back to Tzfat because I told you I did that four holy city tour, right? So when I ended up in the city of Air, I was like, this, I want to be here someday. And so I ended up going to yeshiva up in Tzfat, and I actually lived in a cave for most of my time, a catacomb beneath the street level of Tzfat.
Gold Farbs?
I know the Gold Farbs. They're friends of mine. But no, I was up the mountain a little bit.
Because they have a cave under their house.
They do have a cave, yeah. So I lived in a different cave, but it was probably part of the same street level of Tzfat before the big earthquake in the 1970s.
One of the highlights of my life in Israel has been giving an hour and a half impassioned political speech to Kabbalistic rabbis in a cave in Tzfat.
That's awesome.
It was
awesome.
One of the greatest things. Anyways,
yeah. Go ahead. Yeah, no. So I ended up in this yeshiva, and I think the amazing thing about being as part of this spiritual community was to the perpetual nature of it. I mean, you know, getting up for like Nate's Minyan at dawn and davening and then learning like forever. And then having the evening Seder where you got to learn all the cool Kabbalah classes and whatever. And then, you know, you're up again. And it was just eating, breathing, dreaming in at this point, not only Hebrew, but Aramaic and everything, and Yiddish and English and everything else that's happening there. And being part of this really funky, really inclusive, really loving community. And having a couple, I remember at one point I had a girl over in my cave. And one of the rabbis came down to grab me for minyan, and he walks in, and you know, we're just sitting there talking to each other. But it was like, you know, you weren't supposed to be having girls over, you know?
Yeah.
And I had this long walk to the minyan, thinking, oh man, you know, he saw me, so I'm going to get ratted out, and someone's going to give me some tochacha, they're going to talk to me, or maybe they get kicked me out of the yeshiva, you know, whatever. I didn't know what was going to happen. And day after day goes by, and no one says anything, no one looks at me askance, whatever, and I realize, all right, we're learning all these Lashon Hara classes. This guy's not
about gossiping,
and this guy's not allowed under the halacha to tell anyone what he saw. And yeah, sure enough, to my knowledge, no one ever that what he saw was never transmitted to anyone. You know, and it was an amazing thing for me to live in a spiritual community where people were not only learning. I think a lot of, quite honestly, one of the frustrations I have, I think people do a lot of learning and not a lot of
living the learning.
Exactly. And Shalom.
That's what they say special. Emunah is. It's not just faith, but it's faithfulness to a knowledge. Like to be faithful to what you know. You know, that's what Avraham Avinu was. He was able to connect from his head to his heart. You know, and that's what the Rambam says, the greatest distance in the world is to bridge that gap.
Yeah.
You know, so I also love the laws of gossip. I love that stuff. Because number one, when you're about to gossip to someone and they say, I'm sorry, I don't speak that, you know they're also not speaking that about you.
Right.
You know, that's and true. Like it just takes you to a higher level. Anyways, so you were experiencing this.
So I'm experiencing this. And, you know, as part of this process, there was this great reconciliation with my mother. Who looked at me one day as she saw the writing on the wall, this was before this, you know, and she says, don't you realize you're subscribing to this patriarchal rule-based religion? Like, you're swallowing this stuff. And I looked at her and I thought, wow, you know, right, I grew up with no father, so that's, I want a patriarch, I want a father figure. And I grew up with no rules, not even a bedtime, not anything, and there's this, like, set of rules, and it makes sense to me, and to be honest with you, a lot of it, I think, too, had to do with what I had seen about male-female relationships. That I had seen that male-female relationships involved a lot of violence and a lot of coercion and romance was awful. And a lot of nudity and craziness when I was a kid. And suddenly to be in a community where there was a real solid, respectful distance between male and female. There were these solid lines where there wasn't any messiness. Also, was a you know, the whole package was a rebellion from what I had been raised in. You know,
unbelievable.
It was like, and what does every young person?
Because you know, it's almost like you experienced a truth. A lot of people, you know, don't like the ol malchut shamayim. Yeah. You know, the yoke of heaven.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's a, who wants a yoke on
it's
them?
It's heavy. Yeah.
But when you see, like, a bull without a yoke, it's like slamming its head into trees and it's just right. destroying things.
Right.
You
right.
give it, it can actually do something. It right. can do something constructive and good. It likes the yoke. It's good. And it sounds like you saw the insanity. You're like, put it on me.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. And it, I mean, you know, it's the grass is always greener, but it's hilarious to me because, you know, you see people who, want to fry out, so to speak, or I want to go do, you know, and I had the ability to be like, oh, what are you offering me? Drugs? Which kind of drugs? Yeah, my mom was into those. That's not cool at all, right? My mom did all that. You want to know what opium is about? I remember my mom telling me about when she did opium and, you know, whatever. You want to go have like unrestricted kind of sexual relationships with all kinds of people. Yeah, as a kid, I saw all that happen and all the messiness and awfulness and, you know, disease that went along with that. And you want to be involved in violence or you want to start a new utopian community or, you know, whatever it is that people think that they want to do. I'm like, yeah, I have some experience with that, you know, and no, thank you. You know, I'm going to take a pass on that. You know, for me, the rebellion was really important in bringing me back to the Jewish tradition. But I think for me, there's an important aspect of it, too, which is that my mother got into it, too. And I think that it would have been weird. I always hate those stories where people say, well, after I made tshuva, like, I went back and I wouldn't even eat off my parents' dishes and I wouldn't even go to their house because I'm so much better than they are now or something. You know, I hate to hear that story. Yeah. And so my mother, you know, like, when I went to college, she went to college. When I got a job, she got a job. And as I became more and more interested in Judaism, she became interested in it. And it, the most amazing thing you know, I don't want to get too much into this topic, but we had this ongoing running fight about the Israeli-Arab crisis because my mother is a real dyed-in-the-wool radical, you know, and her programming is to be pro, quote-unquote, underdog.
Pro-underdog. No, and that is the only necessary qualification to make you... Okay.
To make you a hero. And
that's why I feel like Israel should always reposition it from the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to the Muslim-Jewish conflict because now... We are the David and they are certainly
1.3 billion to 12 yeah. million or whatever. Yeah, I mean, it's... But what's fascinating is no matter how many arguments I made and no matter how brilliantly I thought I explained things, she wasn't willing to hear it from me. And when she came to visit me at a later date in Israel, because she's my mother, she ended up meeting some bohemian Israeli artist woman who was the same age and she left me and went around the country driving around with her new friend. And her new friend's telling her, oh yeah, there's the Kinneret, there's the Sea of Galilee. We used to water ski there as teenagers and the Syrian snipers would shoot at us as we were going. That was part of the excitement of water skiing. Every once in a while they'd hit someone, one of my friends died or something. You know, my mother's like, why would the Syrian snipers be shooting at you just because you're water skiing? And she's like, because we're Jews. Like, that's, they wanted to kill us, you know. And this was during the first Lebanon War, you know, during the...
1982.
This is during the southern Lebanon when Israel had the security zone.
Sure.
So this is actually late 90s at this point. So my mother is up and she decides to go stay with this friend of hers, this new friend of hers, in Kiryat Shmona. And this massive Katyusha rocket attack happens and they end up evacuating most, if not all, of Kiryat Shmona. It's this massive evacuation. And my mother, who just happens to be in town for the day, is taken to be she's one of the refugees, right? They evacuate her out. And as they bring them south, home after home, town after town, are throwing open their houses, throwing open their couches, their beds to accept.
I remember that.
They're refugees.
A complete absorption of the northern.
Yeah. In like 24 hours, everyone. Yeah. And my mother is one of the refugees. She's now officially a war refugee. And... she calls, and the Katyushas were exploding, and the whole thing was frightening. I didn't even know this was happening, because at this point I was like in Jerusalem, you know, at Eishet Torah. And she calls...
So funny how you could be in such a small state, and not even know what's going on don't turn on any...
I didn't have a cell phone, you know. Yeah. And she, I think it may even have been Shabbat, I can't remember what the circumstance was, but she ends up calling her boyfriend back in Washington State, and saying, oh, I'm okay. And he says, well, why would you not be okay? And she said, well, the country's under attack. There's a war. The Hezbollah has opened up a new front, and I'm a refugee, you know. And he goes, oh, there's nothing on the news about it. I don't know anything about it. There's no reporting. And then she called him the next day, and he said, oh, it's on the news. Israel's attacking Lebanon. They're launching shells into Lebanon. And for my mother, who had always had, you know, this distrust of, you know, the mainstream, everything, she was like, oh. And it, like, the coin dropped. And she was like, oh, okay. Okay, I see what's happening. And she had to have that experience, because there was nothing that I could have said that would have helped her. And now in the National Public Radio affiliates in the Bay Area or in Portland, Oregon, when they're espousing all kinds of anti-Israel stuff, there's always like the lone caller who calls, who cares enough to call to defend Israel. It's my mother, you know, to defend Israel. And she's adorable, you know, and she's out there trying to reason with these people who just can't be reasoned with.
But so she became, was it a 180?
It was a 180. It was a 180. Yeah, my mother is one of these people who, she, unlike I think a lot of the folks that I know on the left, I mean, she's not a soundbite person. She needs to understand things really deeply and really. And so she's kind of did her research after that, and she read up on these things. And
the anomaly, you know, for me, though, is that there was nothing you could say, because that's really my experience. Some people I meet, mm-hmm. and very soon you realize there's just nothing I'm going to say that's going to actually change them.
Right, right. Because it's a faith. It's really a faith.
It becomes a faith. Yeah. Yeah.
The thing that I did, the thing that was important, I think, for my mother that did begin to sway her is she used to have this perspective of there'd be like a suicide bomber. And I had a friend who, Sarah Duker, who was killed on a bus bombing. And this was 96. And, you know, my mother would say, oh, well, what must Israel have done to make these poor guys so desperate that they had no choice but to commit suicide?
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, that's ridiculous. What are you talking about? You know, and we'd get in these conversations. And I think when September 11th happened, we had this conversation that sort of solidified for her. She, you know, my mother was a Central American rights activist her whole life. And she, and I said, look, can you think of any people that the United States has victimized more than the Guatemalans or the Nicaraguans or the Salvadorans, where we back these like repressive death squads that like massacred entire villages? And, you know, no, my mother's like, yeah, these are the people like that
real grievances.
And I'm like, you think it was Guatemalans on those planes crashing into the World Trade Center? You think it was Salvadorans on those planes? No. You know, you and I both know, because people react to different things in different ways. And as it turned out, of course, it was like, you know, middle-class, well-educated Saudis living in Germany, you know?
People need to put it in this prism of desperation and poverty. Yeah. When Osama bin Laden is like he could have had 150 wives living in a castle.
Right.
And instead he was fleeing from place to place, spent some time in caves. Right. This isn't that.
Right. You know? This isn't that. And I think, and the conversation that I'd had back in the 90s with my mother, I think, as I said, you know, because my mother, very much like so many people, has this perspective of, we're all the same. We're all exactly alike. So if someone would commit suicide, the only way that I can imagine them committing suicide is because they're so depressed, right? Because we can't imagine that someone in America, in our milieu, would commit suicide as an offensive weapon, right? That doesn't seem possible.
To me, something I see a lot is this, I'm not saying your mother is this, but a Western arrogance and refusing to say there are different prisms through which people experience the world.
Right.
We can't project the way we see it on everybody.
Right.
You know, like a lot of Hezbollah guys, right? As a Jew, I would look at them and say, oh, they're cowards. They hide behind their women and children. But they're looking at us and saying, look at those cowards that aren't willing to sacrifice their women and their children for the cause.
Right, right.
You know, totally different worldview. Totally. Yeah.
Well, and the way that I got her with that is I said, do you think in Viking society that looting and raping and pillaging were encouraged? Yeah, of course, the Vikings were terrible. Well, and do you think in Viking society that these people were seen as morally good, that they deserved to be leaders because they were like homicidal maniacs? Yeah, Viking society. It's like, well, if it can be true of Vikings, who are these white, you know, patriarchal, blonde people, right, who you can conceive of as having a different culture, could there be other cultures that are different, with different value systems, that also value homicidal tendencies, that also value honor over justice, that also value, you know? And once I opened that up, my mother was like, okay, well, maybe it's possible that these guys have a different, you know. And I was like, okay, if it's possible, then, you know. So that, I think, was the last chasm between us. And I mean, it's great. I am now like the father of of three Jewish daughters who, you know, are products of or in Jewish day schools. And I look at my girls and the childhood that they're having and the learning that they're having, and I feel like really happy. And seeing my daughter at that bat mitzvah, and that was part of her speech.
Your daughter was just bat mitzvah.
She was just bat mitzvah. Yes. Thank you. At a place called Shvili Zim in Tal Shachar in the center of the country of Israel, and she said, and she gave that in her speech. She said, I'm the first person in 110 years in my family to celebrate this bat mitzvah, and I wanted to do it here, you know, in our homeland. And I thought, thank God that she doesn't have to go through all that wandering and deprivation.
You were the generation in the desert.
I was Dora Midbar. Yeah, I was.
Okay, well, I could go on speaking to you for a while, but we just hit the hour. And most of our listeners know we usually keep our shows to a healthy half hour. But I got to thank you. People can get your book. There's a DVD you gave me. I'm excited to watch it. That you were in Sundance Film Festival, little chapter or intro to your book this year, called Crime After Crime. You're a lawyer.
Yes.
In addition to all of this, and you, survivors of domestic abuse. Yeah. You try to get them out of jail.
Yeah, women who've protected themselves against their batterers, I try to get them out of prison. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, no. So we had a documentary made about one of our cases. One of my cases is called Crime After Crime. It was premiered on the Oprah Winfrey Network and went to Sundance.
Right.
And then I have my literary memoir called Free Spirit, Growing Up on the Road and Off the Grid.
That's what I was saying. You did me a kindness. You give me this book. I don't read books. I'm going to read it.
Okay, good.
I'm going to read it, okay? Because I'm really excited to read it. And I think that's the way people could really get to know you and your journey. Free Spirit, where could they get that?
They can get it's online at Amazon or at your local bookseller or from the library. And it's also on barnesandnoble.com and...
I think you got a link to it on your site also, which is Josh Safran.
It's J Safran.
J Safran.
At jsafran.com, which is JSAFRAN, or freespiritbook.net.
Freespiritbook.net. I would say highly recommend it, but I haven't read it yet. But when I do, then I will come back and tell you how I recommend it, but I have no doubt. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yehoshua Safran.
Exactly.
The best place to stay in Jerusalem is Windows of Jerusalem Apartments. Windows of Jerusalem Vacation Apartments offers luxury 5-star short and long-term rental apartments in the heart of Jerusalem city center. Elegant and modern, inviting and comfortable. The view, the location, the great apartments, and the staff will truly make you feel at home in Jerusalem. Book your stay now at windowsofjerusalem.com. That's windowsofjerusalem.com.
Hello, my name is Tommy Waller. I'm the founder and president of HaYovel. More than 12 years ago, I made my first trip to the land of Israel. What I saw and heard changed my life forever. I stood with Nir Levi, an Orthodox Jewish man in his vineyard in Samaria on the Mountain of Blessing. There, he opened his Bible and read the prophecy of Jeremiah that said, "You shall yet plant vineyards on the mountains of Samaria." We have the opportunity to join Israel as it celebrates the 50th year of the liberation of Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria. Come join us as we witness the unveiling of prophecy in the Jubilee year. Come be a part of the biblical narrative. Go to HaYovel.com, that's HaYovel.com, to find out more. And I hope to see you there.